Hi, Silas. Hello.
Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, yes. Tell all of our listeners out there what you want them to know about your book.
Well, Flavors from Home, it's basically a collection of inspiring stories of some of the refugees who resettled here in Kentucky over the last half century. So it's not just current years, but I go all the way back to even 1957, when a refugee came over after the Hungarian Revolution. So the unique take on this book is that I also include their favorite recipes, their favorite dishes from their homelands. So I've got about 42 different recipes, and yes, I tested them all out myself. And there's about 23 different stories, and about 13 different countries are represented. And I try to focus on those countries that we have the most of here, not only in Kentucky, but throughout the United States, like Cuba, Bhutan, Burma, Somalia, Iraq, Vietnam, DRC, which is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So countries like that.
Right. Well, the book is full of recipes, but it's not, I wouldn't call it a cookbook, would you?
No, I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, at first I kind of bristled when I heard people describing it like that. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with, you know, cookbooks, but it's a narrative cookbook, I guess, is the pithiest way to describe it. Because it is full of the stories, and food kind of is the element that unifies all the stories. But also, you know, what I tried to do was give a brief snapshot, a historical sketch of what happened in those countries that made it so these refugees had to flee, and then what it's been like for them to assimilate here in Kentucky in the United States. And I also even have some sidebars of, you know, just interesting ingredients that the reader should know about, or just different tidbits about cultural differences and things like that. So it did definitely take a lot of research.
Yes, there's just so many layers to it. I mean, it's such a great book for discussion, you know. This book first came out, what, a couple of years ago?
It did, yes.
And now
and then just recently came out in paperback.
Right.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, you know, the topic of immigration continues to be in the news. And in a way, this book is even more relevant than when it first came out. Wouldn't you agree?
Definitely, definitely. But, you know, it's been around for a long time, just this age-old fear, you know, of the unknown, hatred, differences. So in that way, it's kind of universal. I think it speaks to all generations at all times. But like you said, especially now.
Right. Now, have any of the refugees or the immigrants that you work with on this book or others, have you talked to them about the current state of immigration? And I mean, if so, how are they feeling about that right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, probably now I speak more to my students about that than even the refugees that I had featured in the book. And, you know, I think they're just kind of in the same state that a lot of us are in. You know, there's the confusion, the fear, you know, what's going on? They're constantly changing the reforms. You know, what's going on? And I got to also tell you that I think they've been through so much, so many traumatic experiences. It's kind of like they're a little bit desensitized, I think, to it. They're kind of nothing shocks them anymore.
Right.
And there's a little bit of part of them that I think is afraid to speak out or say anything negative because of just what they've witnessed before in their own homelands. That definitely gets you in trouble. But also I'm seeing those that are not U.S. citizens, now there's a big push for them to become citizens. I think they feel more protected if that were to happen.
Mm-hmm.
There is a higher percentage of refugees who get their citizenship than just immigrants in general. So that's definitely something. It just shows how much they want to assimilate in our communities.
Mm-hmm. I read recently that Louisville has one of the biggest refugee populations in the United States. Now, why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, and it's not even just Louisville. It's really our own Kentucky.
Oh, yeah?
Kentucky is among the top 10 states.
People wouldn't expect that, would they?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but here's the key. It's the top 10 state for refugee resettlement per capita. So, of course, you still got California, Texas, New York, I think Michigan and Ohio is up there, too. They're processing more in sheer numbers. But when you look at per capita, for example, I had to look this up not too long ago for a presentation, and I think 2016 was the most recent stat I could find. But out of, say, 100,000 residents here in Kentucky, there's 54 refugees. And that's actually double the national average.
Wow.
Which is only about 25 or so per capita. So that's kind of the difference there. But yes, and Louisville in particular is one of the highest, has one of the highest Cuban populations.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are just surprised by that too. And I think part of that, going back to your question, why is this? We've got several amazing refugee resettlement agencies. Mm-hmm. We've got Catholic Charities, of course, Kentucky Refugee Ministries.
Right.
And when I was doing research for the book, I wasn't as familiar with the one down in Bowling Green. And I believe they still have a satellite office in Owensboro, but they're, I believe they're called International Center of Kentucky. So with all these organizations working to help resettle refugees, as you can imagine, over time, it's kind of been like a little bit of word of mouth.
Yeah.
And, you know, they try to put refugees where there's already kind of nucleus of their own kind there so that it will help them assimilate and to kind of make sure that they can succeed and they've got that support system. So there's a couple of things at play, but also Louisville is very forward-thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a mayor who understands the benefits of you know, diversity, and that's great for our workforce, for the growth of our city, just like I said, cultural diversity. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on, too, that plays into why we have so many numbers.
Amy, what is it about food that draws us together so easily?
Well, that's another great question. You know,
it's a hard question.
What's that?
It's maybe a hard question because, it's just so,
yeah.
It makes so much sense the way it draws us together. But how do you articulate that?
Right, right. Well, and one of the things that I was noticing every time I went into these homes, it's such an overpowering sensory experience.
Mm.
And I think, you know, it's because of really all of the senses are engaged when you think about it, especially if we're talking about the preparation of the food. I mean, you've even got the sound, you know, the chopping or the frying. You've got the sight of the presentation of the meal. You've got, of course, the taste. And a lot of refugees, you know, eat with their hands, and there's the touch aspect, and just, of course, the smells. So, you know, we're taught, especially as a teacher, you know, we try to engage all the senses because that helps commit things to memory better. So I think that's why it's so highly attached to memory and evokes so many emotions because there's so many, you know, senses involved. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. And there's just something about sitting across the table from somebody, you know, it's like it forces you into conversation, and it's humanizing also to see somebody eat, you know.
Right, this basic thing that we all share in common. And I think touching on what you were saying, it's just like you can finally relax. You can sit, you know, in your seat and just your defenses are kind of let down a little bit. You're not quite as on guard, and you're just, you know, you're just ready to eat and do something primal, you know?
Right, right.
And it's very non-threatening.
Yes. Now, this question is probably like asking someone to choose their favorite child, but I want to ask you what your favorite dish in the book is, if you can narrow it down to one or two.
It is. It's just like that. And, you know, it depends on my mood, too, because I know I've gone in and out of these phases where I've gone back to some of these recipes. I can say that I like every recipe in the book, and that's saying something for 42 recipes.
Yeah, it is.
There's not a one that I do not like, but there certainly are ones that I tend to navigate back to, and one of those is Well, there's a couple. One is emadachi, and that's a Bhutanese dish. In fact, it's their national dish. And it's, I think it translates into, like a chili and cheese soup. Mm-hmm. And but don't be misled. It's not like our kind of chili and cheese soup that you would imagine. The chili is the hot peppers. There's vegetables. There's cumin, turmeric, all kinds of just yummy smells and taste. And every time I eat it, I feel like I'm eating really nutritiously. It's a great vegetarian dish. So that's one that I definitely love. Oh, and the cheese that they put in there is actually more of a yogurt. So you can substitute mm-hmm. for us. Here is you can do a Greek yogurt, and it's just so, so delicious. So that's one I love, and it's very easy to make. The other one, and this one surprised me, it's an African dish, specifically from Central Africa, and it's called pondu, and it translates cassava leaves, which is kind of from the yucca plant. And they use the leaves instead of just the root. They also use the leaves so that no part of the plant is wasted. And this one is really, talk about, just so many flavors in your mouth all at once. It's also got hot peppers, eggplant, onion, garlic. Mm. But the thing is, it's in this peanut butter-based, broth. And then... what else is in there? They can do smoked fish, and that's kind of a delicacy for them, but when they have it available, they'll put that in, and I really love that additional smokiness to it. And it is just, I don't know, it's an addictive flavor for me. Wow. And, they serve it with I think it's called fufu, yes. Fufu is like, have you ever had that... Silas, it's kind of like a gummy mashed potato is the best way I can describe it. But it's kind of their equivalent to our rice and bread. It's just one of those side, kind of bland, just something, to anchor the side of your mm-hmm. dish there. But they use their hands and scoop it up this dish, the stew, with this fufu.
We're talking to Amy Zarian, author of Flavors from Home, here on WUKY 91.3 FM. Well, I've been a big fan of your writing for a long time, and this book is just beautifully written. But it's also visually beautiful. The photographs are really great. So tell us a little bit about who did those, and is this somebody you worked along with, or how does that work?
Oh, you know what? That is... You're one of the first people to bring that up, and I appreciate that. One of my girlfriends, who's an amateur photographer in Indiana,
really?
But she just loved this whole book idea and just was really on board and really helped push me out of my comfort zone to do this thing. And her name's Julie Johnston, and so I think she's an excellent photographer.
She is.
But also, Silas, a lot of the pictures I took myself.
Really?
So I take that as a compliment because I haven't had much experience doing photography, but sometimes I was just left to my own resources, and that was me. So I did the best I could. But, something that was important to both Julie and me is to make sure we were not staging it too much. Mm-hmm. A lot of these cookbooks are just, talk about them.
Yeah, they have a food stylist and everything, right?
Yeah, and so I just wanted to make sure that it was looking like it was just very authentic. Whenever I could put it on their own dishes, mm-hmm. That was the optimal way to go. So we just tried to just use what they had in their own homes, and I'm glad it turned out well.
Amy, I know you also have a deep interest in spirituality, especially the teachings of Thomas Merton. How did you first come to know Merton? I mean, Merton's work.
Yeah. I can't even remember. I've probably been reading Thomas Merton for the last 15 years at least or so. Probably learned about him just through my own Catholic upbringing. I was raised Catholic. Probably part of my connection to him is that, some of my relatives, great uncle, a couple of great aunts were of the Benedictine religious order. Mm-hmm. My dad almost became a priest. So there's, before marrying, of course, but there's just a lot of connection there, which is my Catholic roots.
And you went to Bellarmine, which he was so associated
with, right?
Yeah.
That's right. That has the Merton Center now, yes.
And you've recently mm-hmm. become pretty involved in a particular kind of yoga. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. Okay, it's called Bow Spring, and I get very excited talking about this. I'm glad you brought it up. It's just one of my new passions or obsessions, whatever you want to call it. But it's B-O-W, Bow Spring. And it originated out in Colorado. The co-creators are Desi Springer and John Friend. So it's been out for a while, but just like many things and trends, you know, here in Kentucky, you're just slowly moving across the country to get to us. But it already has like a global following, a global movement. So hopefully people will be learning about it more soon enough. But I started it about a year ago, and it's really transformed my body. I had some chronic back pain that I was going to a chiropractor for, and it's definitely has relieved that, and I no longer go to a chiropractor. But basically, it's just this new postural alignment system, I guess is the best way to describe it. And it's trying to bring, you know, just the best balance in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So every movement is very mindful, purposeful. If you kind of think about, I've never done Tai Chi, but it's very gently, a lot of gentle movements. But it just packs a big punch. Even though the moves look innocent enough, it's very strenuous. You get a great workout. And it's also, you know, just think light and springy, but it's also coming from a place of strength and athleticism. So the other unique thing about it is it works on your connective tissue. And that's a lot of what people aren't, you know, concentrating on and should be, because, you know, arthritis, fibromyalgia, people that had a lot of sports injuries, like I said, chronic back pain, it's very helpful. People are finding a lot of healing through this method. And it's kind of the response to, you know, we're all hunched over our devices these days. And it's kind of a solution to coming back, opening yourself back up to the natural S curve or double S curve that's in your back. So it's really cool. And it's got a lot of spiritual aspects to it that I like to. Just this day and age, Salas, as you know, just everybody closed off and walled off from others. And it's just the whole philosophy about it is making yourself open and receptive. And it's how, first and foremost, you're just holding your body and moving through the world. So, yeah, I love it. I hope more people will find out about it and enjoy its benefits.
Sounds like you need to write about this. Do you have any plans for that?
No. You know what I'm finding as a writer here? I'm trying to talk myself out of it, just like I did with Flavors from Home. There was this part of me, and I think you know this, that kind of wrestled with, oh, I'm not a food writer by trade. I've never written about food. And, oh, somebody else needs to write it. It's a great idea, but somebody else needs to write about that.
Yes.
And I really went back and forth, and I finally had a writer friend looked to me and she said, you know, Amy, sometimes it takes writing about that subject to become the authority or to become the expert,
exactly.
You know? And that's why we write a lot of times, right? To understand something better. So, yeah, I might end up doing it after all, but I'm kind of in that little fearful mode. But I think that it could bring a lot of healing to the world. And anymore, that's what I'm about. I want to do what I can my small part to bring more light and compassion to the world, as I know you do too in your writing and work.
Well, speaking of healing, what books have you been loving recently?
Oh my gosh. Well, over Christmas, I read Tom Hanks' Uncommon Type, his first collection of short stories. Have you read it yet, Silas?
No, I've read a lot about it. What'd you think?
Well, you know, at least a thumb and a half up, if not two thumbs up. I really did enjoy it, and I was pleasantly surprised that, you know, I was able to read the stories without thinking that Tom Hanks wrote this story. You know how sometimes you're looking at a movie or something on TV that's got a really big celebrity, and you almost can't get past their celebrity status. So I was glad to see that, you know, his writing was strong enough, his voice was strong enough, characters were complex enough that I was able to just totally, you know, be in the story and not think about the author. And a lot of his playfulness and humor that we see on screen, you kind of came out in these stories. So I did enjoy that one. And the other one that I'm really excited about, and kind of ties in with Bow Spring, actually, this is the creator of Bow Springs' sister, so Micah Springer. She wrote this beautiful book called Keepers of the Story, and it's a memoir, but, you know, for those who are not really into memoir, don't be fooled by that or don't be turned off by that. It actually reads kind of like an adventure novel, and she writes about the time that in 1993, she and a girlfriend from college decided to go backpacking for 1 year through Africa. And you can only imagine, like, the trials they faced and the dangers. That's very dangerous. And they were, this was before cell phones or any way to connect back with family. And
you mean just the terrain?
And, you know, and yes. Yeah. And she fell in love with a nomadic warrior. So it's also a love story. And just, you know, the wisdom she learned through these different cultures. So I actually was so moved by it, I wrote her, and I told her, you know, it's very rare that in one book, or really in one chapter, I can laugh out loud and cry like a baby. And, you know, it's just, you know, beautiful writing, but also just a beautiful story and the importance of, you know, passing on these stories and remembering.
Great. Say the title one more time.
It's called Keepers of the Story.
Okay.
And you can get it on Amazon, I know.
Okay. Well, to close us down, what is a song that you always think of in relation to your book that you'd like everyone out there to hear today, if you have one?
Yes. There was one that I did listen to periodically, Motherland by Natalie Merchant. Mm. And it's just the melody, I don't know if you're familiar with the style, it's
yes,
kind of haunting, but it's, you know, just this, I think it's that bittersweet of leaving your homeland, and yet even as bad as that homeland sometimes is or was, you know, it's still your home. And so it's just a beautiful lyrics, beautiful melody.
Yeah, it's a great one. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Amy.
All right. Thanks, Silas.
I hope all of you out there will look for the book Flavors from Home by Amy Zarian. And you can find out more about Amy and her book at amyzarian.com. That's AimeeZarin.com. Amy has chosen the last song perfectly for us today. Here's Motherland by Natalie Merchant. Until next time, be good to one another.